Good evening, and welcome once again to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. We're happy to return to discuss landlord-tenant law, the first installment, the first of two, that is, for the spring of 2024. I'm the host of Your Legal Rights, Jeff Hayden, and we've been discussing this theme for some time. It seems that California has spent the last 20 years creating jobs, 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 but they haven't necessarily been as good about creating housing. A shortage was inevitable. Housing prices reached an unsustainable level. Purchase prices are ever higher, forcing people into the rental market, where more and more people compete for rentals, bidding that price up. Where people compete with short-term rentals in addition to other prospective renters. But is build, build, build really the solution? You also look through various parts of San Francisco and see such large developments as Park Merced, with a vacancy rate of somewhere between 25 and 30%. You look at redevelopment plans for such facilities as Stonestown that was going to have a large housing component, but those have been put on hold because of all these vacancies throughout the city. Now, recent news suggests that higher interest rates played a role, delayed a certain amount of demand, but we've seen in the last 2 months, at least in the Bay Area, it seems that even though people are now putting their housing on the market for the first time in the last couple of years, that the prices are nonetheless going up and prices are getting bid and these houses are disappearing. What is that doing to the rental stock? Well, that being said, housing and landlord-tenant in particular have been some of the area that's been the most volatile in terms of the law the last couple of years. Legislature's been very active. What other new developments are on the horizon? What changes are happening right now? And what have gone into effect in recent months? And what are we looking at down the road? As always, we want you, our most important guest, to join our conversation. So give us a call. Our phone number is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're not in the San Francisco Bay Area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. Now, our attorney guest can't always give you very specific advice. They haven't seen all of the ins and outs of a particular case. Even a night like tonight, where we have three attorneys extraordinaire amongst the best, they're happy to give you guidance. They're happy to help you sort out legal principles. And we're happy to help you find help out there that's specific to your case. Returning tonight, our guests are three of the Bay Area's top landlord-tenant attorneys. For some 20 years, San Francisco landlord-tenant attorney Jessica Chalik represents clients in rent board actions, mediations, and court for landlord-tenant issues. Jessica launched her practice to specialize in San Francisco residential evictions, vacancy agreements, and rent board petitions for tenants, landlords, and master tenants and subtenants. Also joining us tonight from San Mateo, attorney David Finkelstein is a graduate of NYU School of Law. David's admitted to practice in the states of California and New York, beginning his career as a staff attorney in California for the National Housing Law Project at what was then Bolt Hall School Law School. And for the last 40 years or more, David's been representing clients in real estate and landlord-tenant matters. Also from San Francisco, attorney Sal Timpano is considered one of the top attorneys in the Bay Area to practice in the area of landlord-tenant law, representing both landlords and tenants in the area of eviction. And without further ado, Sal, Jessica, David, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Thank you, David. Jeff.
Good night, Chet. So
right.
We talked a little bit about statewide rent control. Is that showing any signs of easing up?
No, I don't think so. If anything, it's tightening up because under SB 567, in order to evict a client for owner move-in, they tightened up the rules to make it much harder to do that. And also another thing to evict for substantial remodeling has been very much tightened up to require that you have a permit before you even give a 60-day notice, and that you also have to notify the tenant that he would have the right to re-rent the apartment at the same rental rate after you do the remodel. So that was a major exception that is now pretty much gone, I think. So I'll let other anybody else who wants to follow up on that.
Sal, do you have a strong feeling about that? I mean, is SB 567 going to change things? I mean, we're already looking at the statewide rent control. Is this actually the only escape valve that's been bottled up, or are there more on the horizon?
There's actually more going on. Dave, Jeff, there's more going on in the fact that there's been adjustments to Costa Hawkins in the sense that if there are people who have to be moved to another apartment in the building, in a rent-controlled building, or if they have a rent-control unit, because of mobility issues, permanent mobility changes, they have to be moved to a first floor apartment, then they keep the protected rent.
Okay, and I think we may have mentioned in earlier program.
I don't have any volume on the on the computer here. I don't know if somebody touched it, but I don't know how to get any volume.
Nobody touched it.
Okay, they can't hear me and I don't hear them.
We actually hear you, Sal, but you don't hear us.
Okay.
We're obviously having a few technical problems, but we are still here. We're here to help.
Right.
And it does appear that we do have a couple callers in queue. While we iron those things out, the office of the district.
We mentioned already security deposits are now limited to 1 month, pretty much, unless there's a small exemption for small landlords.
While we iron out a few of these problems, let me turn it to Nancy in the East Bay. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi, this is Nancy.
Hi, Nancy. You're on the air.
Great. I have a question about a situation that I just had with my former landlord. There was a history of him intimidating and harassing and threatening me whenever I'd ask for repairs. He tried to tell me, you know, I was responsible for it when it was things that he was responsible for, and then he'd verbally tell me I could, you know, make an improvement to the yard, and now he's telling me that, anyhow, he's basically withholding my security deposit, and he presented me with all of these receipts that are like he's redoing the house at my expense, and I left the place spotless. It was normal wear and tear, and he's just like, he's trying to say that a broken flat on the blinds is going to cost $500 to replace. And it's just, I have to do something. I need to know what to do and how to approach this, because it's just been extremely frustrating. And now, you know, he's refusing to give me my money back.
Do you have photos when you moved in of what it looked like and what you left it, and photos of what you left it like?
Yeah, I have a whole timeline with photos, screenshots of threatening text messages he sent me. I took a video when I left the place and just showed. I had a cleaner come in and clean it for 2 days, and there was some discoloration on the kitchen floor. He said that the whole floors need to be replaced, and the discoloration was like the size of a piece of paper, and it was normal wear and tear. Just little things like that, because it's like he's retaliating against me because I was trying to hold him accountable for just the things he needed to be accountable for as a landlord.
Sure, sure. So section 1950.5 of the California Civil Code covers the security deposit and what can be deducted from it. And if you've got documentation, then you could potentially file a small claims lawsuit against him to get your security deposit back. Has it been more than 21 calendar days since you turned in keys and left?
Excuse me one sec. Before you answer, Nancy, is your radio on in the background?
Let me turn it off. I'm on. Hold on a second. Can you hear me now?
We can.
Okay, I was talking in the car, so maybe that was in the background.
That could be. So, I'm sorry, Jessica, you were just asking?
I was just asking, I was saying that she could file a small claims lawsuit against him. I was asking if it had been more than the 21 calendar days.
Laura, yes, it has. I vacated on February 29th.
Right, so now it has been. So, yes, at this point, if he's not returning your security deposit and he's not providing support, you can file a small claims case in the county where the property is located. And then you can, the small claims case, you can claim back for the whatever you can prove. I mean, if you have your documentation, you know, have a copy for you, a copy for the judge, a copy for the clerk, and a copy for the other side, you know, whether it's photos or whatever, and then, you know, you can present that evidence in small claims court.
Yes, small claims court jurisdiction has been raised as of January 1 to $12,500 for an actual individual. Secondly, the landlord was supposed to have notified you of your right to have a pre-move-out inspection 14 days before you moved out. I don't know if he didn't do that, then he's not entitled to deduct it.
We actually tried to do that. I had contacted him to come for a preliminary walkthrough, and he showed up with two of his family members unannounced, and we were in the process of packing and moving, and they were going through acting as if it was a move-out inspection. And I said, no, we just want to identify some areas. And there was like a fractured bathroom tile that had been there since we came in. And he said that, you know, I damaged it and we needed to replace it. And then he got heated, raised his voice. They stormed out, and we never actually got to finish this walkthrough. And then there was other things that had happened. He had added a bathroom before. Well, there was a second bathroom. So it was listed as a three-bedroom, one bath with the county, but it's actually a two-bath. He has an unpermitted bathroom that he added in, and he, you know, asked me to not bring attention to it when he had an appraiser coming in. And then somebody had told me that if there's unpermitted parts of the house, that there's a possibility of suing him to deduct the rent I paid on that part of the house. Is that correct?
If the unit itself was not permitted, or properly permitted, then there might be some claim for that. I don't know if it, like an unpermitted bathroom that, you know, in the rest of the apartment was, the rest of the unit was permitted would count the same. David, do you have any thoughts?
It's possible that she might, if she could show that a comparative unit without that bathroom would have rented for a couple hundred dollars less, she might have a claim.
If you have a picture or video of the broken bathroom tile before you moved in, then, you know, you would be able to show, look, it was that way when I moved in. It's not my responsibility to fix it.
Although a single tile should not be a major repair, assuming that there's some of the tile left over and saved, chipping out a single tile and replacing it is a pretty minimal thing. I've done it myself, and I am not really handy.
Right. Nancy, I mean, I have two.
He's saying it was $1,700 of hired labor to replace the tile, to replace two tiles in the bathroom.
And they matched the tiles with tiles he already had and just remove them and replace them?
Yep.
That's not credible.
That's basically what's going on.
The other thing that 1950.5 says is that if he uses hired labor, he has to provide some sort of receipt or invoice that has their name and contact information, and then like the day they worked, the hours that they worked, how much were they paid for per hour or whatever, you know. And if it's not like a reputable company, like he didn't go to Home Depot and get, you know, paint and get a receipt from Home Depot, but he hired random people, they have to provide that, you know. If for example, if somebody hired me to clean an apartment, I would have to provide some sort of written summary of what I did.
Nancy, what city are you in?
I'm sorry?
What city are you in? Or what city is the property in?
At Castro Valley, which is unincorporated Alameda County.
What you might consider doing is, if you do go to small claims, you can't have an attorney represent you there. But there's nothing about that would stop you from taking all of your papers and showing them to a landlord-tenant attorney and going through it with them to see if that's your best option and how to present it. And one option you might consider is contacting the Alameda County Bar Association. Their number is 510-302-2222. And you could get a low-cost consultation. Virtually every county in the Bay Area has a bar association that will give you a half-hour consultation with an attorney through the Lawyer Referral and Information Service in that particular locale. And typically, it's in the neighborhood of $30, $35 for a half-hour consultation, which may turn out to be well worth it if it helps you know exactly where your claims are and how to present them in small claims court.
Okay. I've tried to reach out to through some of those lines, and people are wanting to charge me $400 for a consultation.
No, if you do it through small claim, I'm sorry, if you do it through the lawyer referral service, a half-hour consultation should be $30 or $35. And if the attorney is saying, well, that's good for them, but I want more money, circle back to them and let them know. That would probably be grounds to terminate that attorney.
Okay, good. All right. So thank you for the information. I know it's just been a really long and frustrating process, so I want it to be behind me soon.
No, I understand. I wish you the best of luck, and thank you for joining us on Your Legal Rights.
Thank you.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. Tonight we're talking landlord-tenant. Just what is the status of the landlord-tenant relationship? What protections do I have, whether it's against a retaliatory rent increase or, in this case, what a landlord is doing with a security deposit? What's justified, what's not? Tonight's guests, David Finkelstein, Sal Timpano, and Jessica Chalik, are amongst the best landlord-tenant attorneys in the region. If you have questions, my guest, our phone number is 415-841-4134. If you're outside the San Francisco Bay Area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. And as always, you can call regarding any question on tonight's topic, that is anything about landlord-tenant. You don't have to jump in where we are in the conversation. And for those of you who haven't seen it, there's a troubling but quite compelling series on Netflix available right now called An American Nightmare. It looks at a case out of Vallejo where innocent victims of a horrific crime in their own home were further victimized by the public pronouncements of a disbelieving police department and the public furor it incited. In 2 weeks, on April 10th, we examine a most troubling case of confirmation bias, tell you exactly what that means and how it relates to police work, and how two innocent victims had their lives turned around. Best of all, we'll take your calls and answer your questions right here on Your Legal Rights. So, Last spring, we discussed a limitation on what a landlord could charge for a security deposit. It's since been signed into law. Does that have any play, do you think, in a case such as Nancy's, where the landlord is basically keeping a deposit that far exceeds what he would have been able to charge under today's law?
No, the laws are not retroactive. So the change to the security deposit law went into effect at the beginning of the year, but at the, you know, you're going to have to make sure it's in the any new contracts, rental agreements written in 2024.
Yeah, just following up on that last tenant question, seems to me that the whole purpose of the pre-inspection the pre-move-out inspection, that is to give notice to the tenant of what matters were damaged in order to give the tenant sufficient time to correct them so the landlord didn't have to hire somebody to do it. And it sounds to me like in that case that we just heard from the tenant, that wasn't done, that the landlord said, you know, just one thing about the tile and then stormed out without completing the inspection and without, according to what I heard, giving the tenant any kind of written written analysis of what the landlord thought was wrong. So I'm not sure that that pre-inspection qualifies as a pre-inspection. I don't know. What do you think, Jessica?
No, I don't think it does under the circumstances, because, you know, it wasn't a set up time. It wasn't a let's go through and look at what I want to charge you for and what, you know, you're anything like that. And as you said, no written documentation of that, which is required by the actual statute.
I agree with both of you. The tenant in that instance was sort of, you know, robbed of the right to make the corrections herself or to hire somebody herself, which the idea is it might be a lot less expensive for them to do that than pay the landlord, who thereafter comes up with a whole bunch of, you know, repairs based on their substandard pre-inspection or, you know, lack of pre-inspection.
And particularly troubling was what she said about the tile, replacing two tiles they already had and charging hundreds of dollars. I've done that at my house, and I would be shocked if a handyman would have charged 10 cents on the dollar to what he quoted. Let me turn it to Victoria in Los Angeles. Victoria, welcome to the Lawrence. Victoria, are you with us?
Hello?
Hi, Victoria. You're on the air. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Yeah, hi. I'm just having a little problem with the volume here. My situation is a little complex, so I'll try to keep it as simple as possible. I was very ill and had to move back home with my father. And then he suddenly collapsed and died. And I was very ill, like debilitating illness that was worthy of disability. And the trustee handling his estate has been suing me for eviction, actually sued me for eviction, even though I had paid rent in the past. The house is in a trust for 8 beneficiaries, and so it needs to be sold sooner or later. And I was in such shock over finding my father dying, and then various really just disrespectful behavior of this trustee damaging my father's property in the house, and then bullying me and threatening to like pack up all my things and charge me for for the packing and for putting it in storage, because they told me I wasn't allowed to touch anything in the house, although I was living there. And in the kitchen, there were plenty of pots and pans that were mine and plenty that weren't. But in any event, I decided to settle because I was so terrified of, I mean, I was just so harassed and so traumatized, and I didn't want any more of my father's money from the trust being spent on this eviction lawsuit, even though two of my landlord friends in the city of Berkeley were saying, you should stay there, you should stay there, and don't leave because you've paid rent. And I did get some legal aid. However, we did settle, and in the settlement, I insisted that we put in a clause that said no retaliation, because given my experience with this trustee, I mean, they were doing everything they could to harass me, and apparently they broke legal ethics by deposing me during settlement talks, driving up legal fees to the trust. So anyway, I put in no retaliation, and now they have written me stating that they're going to remove from my part of the inheritance all the legal fees and some sort of damages that they're going to add to it. And what are my rights? Because this is kind of a real estate, landlord tenant, and a trust issue all wrapped into one.
Well, I think mainly it's a probate issue having to do with whether they can deduct those fees from your part of the inheritance. You know, because it would depend on the trust that owns the property, you know, what it says about any kind of distribution of the trust and whether those fees can be charged against one of the beneficiaries. So I think it's actually more of a probate question.
Okay.
I know Los Angeles has its own bar association and lawyer referral service, so you might consider calling them.
I'm in Berkeley. I'm just in Los Angeles taking care of some business down here.
Oh,
where is the place you were living? Where was your father's home?
Berkeley.
Okay.
Once again, I would suggest the lawyer referral service of the Alameda County Bar Association.
Okay, is it that same phone number?
That same number, 510-302-2222.
Okay, I got that. Okay, so more of a probate, yeah.
It's kind of a mixed...
retaliation, and now they wanted, you know, they're charging me for my own property that I removed from the house.
Yeah, it's going to take...
My understanding from listening to you is that you were not a named tenant on any lease. Is that right? You were not?
It was informal. It was, you know, my father. So, but right. I do have check registers and bank statements that show that I paid rent.
Yes, I understand. What I'm saying is, in my understanding is in California, you only get attorney's fees if either there is a contract or a lease or an agreement that provides for the prevailing party to get fees, or in the alternative, if there's a statute like in divorce cases. But I'm not seeing the basis of you were not a party to a lease that you signed. I guess you're a beneficiary. Maybe I'm not familiar enough with the probate law, whether there's a statutory provision in the probate that allows fees to be awarded against a beneficiary who interferes with distribution or sales. As far as I know, I don't think there is. I think there's a statute, if the trustee does stuff like that, that the trustee can be charged, but I'm not aware of any probate statute that says a beneficiary can be charged fees.
Yeah, and I understood that it was that the trust was going to have to eat, you know, the entire trust was going to eat those fees, even though this was a completely irresponsible, frivolous lawsuit, because I didn't know I had rights. Because I'd paid rent so many years before, I didn't think it counted. And so I was hightailing it, packing like crazy and, you know, having accidents. And I was sleep deprived and in shock from finding my father dying. And like, I was doing my best to fulfill this person's demands. And I only needed, like, maybe two more days. And they just slapped me with a lawsuit. And that's when I discovered I paid rent 20 years ago. Okay, I have rights.
I would seriously consider getting a copy of the trust.
I do. I have one.
And all your records, and literally get a consultation. This may be a case that you want to seek representation, but at least take a lawyer for a test drive. We have to break. You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 San Francisco. We'll be back right after this.
But I just keep scrolling through all the sugar daddies this and no strings attached that until I see the title, Yankees Tickets and a Toaster.
Join us for more true stories told live. Next time, Objects of Desire, from sizzling skillets and brand new soccer balls to the mysteries of love and toast. That's on the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
The Moth Radio Hour tonight is 7 o'clock here on 91.7 KALW San Francisco, local public radio, serving the Greater Bay Area. Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. And if you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Law Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or you can visit sfbar.org for more information.
The Office of the District Attorney addresses more than the street crimes that most of us hear about in the news. There's a particular focus in virtually every office on environmental law, violations of environmental laws, or consumer protection. And the folks in these arenas have a particularly close relationship historically with this broadcast. In fact, Chuck Finney, the visionary who initiated this broadcast some 40 years ago and maintained it throughout the remainder of his career, spent his entire working life there. Next week, we hear from two such attorneys talking about enforcing laws in environmental crimes and in consumer fraud. Again, that's right here on Your Legal Rights. And you are listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM. We're talking about the status of landlord-tenant relationships, who's protected from eviction, unlawful retainers, things have changed. Does a landlord have to pay his tenants to move? What limits now attach to your security deposits? Tonight's guests, Sal Timpano, Jessica Chalik, David Finkelstein, are among the best landlord-tenant attorneys in the region. If you have questions for my guests, our phone number is 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the San Francisco Bay Area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. And as always, you can call regarding any question on tonight's topic. You're not limited to the exact point we may be in our conversation. I received a call from a listener who called me off-air, was wondering what restrictions that he might have in removing a tenant because their own situation is such that they're going to need that additional space to rent for themselves. What has changed as far as those provisions, taking your rental property back because you're going to need them?
Jeff, not much has changed there, in that landlords in San Francisco for many, many years have the right to serve an eviction notice in order to take back the property for their own use or for the use of a family member in a building that the owner already lives in. And they can bring in as many family members as they want. That's much more restrictive than state law. State law seems to be modeled on San Francisco or maybe some other city, but certainly after San Francisco, in regards to the right of a landlord to take back property in order to live in it themselves. And, they're required to pay some relocation money. So I don't think there's that many changes, except for the fact that before the Tenant Protection Act, there was no statewide scheme for this, and only local jurisdictions had rules. Whether they did or not, was up to the local jurisdiction. Now it's statewide.
Well, there's a recent amendment, SB 567, that says that in the written eviction notice, the name and relationship to the owner of the intended occupant must be given, and include notification that the tenant may request proof that the intended occupant is an owner or related to the owner. Also, the family member has to move in within 90 days after the tenant vacates and must occupy the unit for at least 1 year. And there's all kinds of penalties if that doesn't happen.
Is that coming to into effect in April, David? Or is that, I think you said it was an ABA?
Effective April 1, you're right.
Yep. So, yeah, that's modeled pretty closely to San Francisco. So it seems like the state may be taking its cues from already existing rent ordinances and then having them apply to the entire state.
Let me turn it over
to... Seems like for most of the state, those won't apply for most of the, you know, cities. But it will apply in the big city. You know, it will be used. I don't mean apply. I mean as far as how it's used in the big cities, you know, San Diego, Los Angeles, San Francisco, some of the other bigger cities. These laws are going to be, you know, used by landlords and tenants. There's a lot of small cities in San Francisco where they, you know, just don't. They're never going to see the light of day because the issue just doesn't come up.
Let me turn it over to Vicki in Menlo Park. Vicki, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Thank you. I'm calling regarding a tenant that I have. I own an ADU, and the tenant hasn't paid rent in 9 months because he lost his job. And I'm told the settlement was he just moved out, but it would not be on his record. And I'm trying to see if I can recoup the money from him by going to collections.
I think you can.
There?
Yes, I would think unless you signed an agreement waiving the rent, that yes, when he moves out, you could take him to small claims court, which has now been raised to $12,500. Try to collect it. If he's unemployed, you might get a judgment, but that doesn't mean it's collected because we don't have any debtor's prison like they've had in other countries. So our country was founded on no debtor's prison. So if he is unemployed and doesn't have a bank account, you'll get a judgment against him, but it probably is not going to be collectible.
At least until he gets employment, because once he's employed again, then it's possible that you might be able to collect. Judgments are good for 10 years and renewable for 10-year stints for the life of the person who owes the money.
This is the unfortunate. Thank you so much for your time. The unfortunate thing is there's always a landlord and there's a tenant. And this is the first time I'm a landlord. I've worked with an affordable housing program to be able to, you know, provide housing. Within 2 months of him moving in, he all of a sudden lost his job, and then for 9 months has not paid, as I stated. And so with the agreement was with the attorney, I guess, just to get him out, but he walks away free, and it's like, you can do this to another landlord. And that's the unfortunate thing, I think, is that I've been told this is a scammer, a professional scammer.
Do you think this is true of your individual tenant, or are people telling you this is something that some folks do?
No, I think based on this individual, he checked out. He said he was a contractor that worked with solar panels, so he was a subcontractor type. And so I checked them out, found it completely legit, met with them numerous times. I have a property manager, ran all the background checks. But then literally within 2 months. And what I get to see is him go play golf every day. But hasn't made any effort to pay the rent at all.
Well, you didn't have to agree with your attorney to sign an agreement that would let him leave in exchange for no rent. You could have had your attorney pursue an eviction action, and it might have delayed somewhere between 30 to 60 days evicting him. But you know what you're saying is you didn't agree with the procedure that your attorney was recommending, but you know, you I don't know if you've already signed it or not. You don't have to.
I haven't signed anything because I work with a nonprofit. They're doing a ground lease agreement here, which is a very unique situation. And it seemed like what I was being told, because I didn't meet with the attorney, the organization was working with them, but it's on my property. That in order to get him out, they came up with this settlement of, as I stated, he leaves, it's supposed to leave April 8th, which is coming up very soon, and it won't go on his record. He won't have any eviction on his record. And, you know, I think the unfortunate thing, as I stated, is he's going to do this to somebody else again because it's not on his record. And so if it's not on his record, it seems like it's going to require a process for me to try to attempt to recoup the money, which is almost $20,000 that he hasn't paid in rent.
Yeah, so it sounds like you've got an issue with the fairness of this whole thing, in addition to the money that's owed to you. But it might be much more expensive for you to pursue the judgment, as David had mentioned, which is something you can do. But then when you get the judgment, it may end up being a judgment that you can't collect upon anytime soon. And so you've got the judgment. He's going to have a record, this tenant. But you're not going to get paid your judgment,
you know,
for your efforts.
I always hear the side of the tenant, and I understand the side of the tenant, but we never get to hear the side of the landlord, who's basically getting screwed over. When I just have one unit, one ADU, and it's brand new. It's
all
permitted.
Question.
Yes.
Okay, so my question then for you is, you said it's you're working through a nonprofit. Can the nonprofit, you know, reimburse you some portion of that?
I just met with them yesterday, and that is what we're in the discussion, because it's a ground lease. This is a very unique program where it's a ground lease agreement. They lease my land to build the ADU. But we work together in partnership.
Right, and so you own the land and they own the ADU, and they rent out the ADU on your property.
Yes, or I could pay it off.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not going to happen right away. So I've lost the money because it's $2,200 I charge, or it's a one bedroom, brand new, air conditioning, washer, dryer, their own yard, and their own walk entrance. And so out of that, I get half, and half of it goes towards the construction of the cost for the construction. So at this point, no one has received anything. And as I met with them yesterday, I said, I feel like this is like a rapist getting away with rape, and no one is getting press charges. That's what this tenant is doing. He's going to get away with not paying rent and do it to another landlord because he has his scam down.
Yeah, and I understand. It's a difficult situation.
If you do get a judgment against him, people will be able to see that.
And oh, yes.
One thing you can do to expedite that, depending on how much might be reimbursed elsewhere, you could sue him for under the legal limit in small claims court. That will get you somewhere about 60 cents on the dollar from the money you're describing. And in the meantime, mm-hmm. you get a judgment. It goes on his record. Particularly if the nonprofit is going to reimburse part of your expenses, it might be a way to go and save you a lot of expense and, mm-hmm. and trouble.
So a small claims court is what you would suggest.
Yes.
That will get you up to, I believe it's currently $12,500 after the first of the year. It's not all the money, but it's 60 cents on the dollar, and you won't have the long, protracted litigation in a civil suit.
I mean, I would like it to be on his record if I can, because it's so unfair that this would happen to another landlord, because he knows his tenant's rights.
If the small claims court issues a judgment, it is as valid a judgment as any other court's judgment. And so, yes, if you record it in the county that you get it from, you're in. So, if you record it, then it will show up on like title searches and things like rental companies that sort of pre-screen potential tenants, and it will show up on, credit reports and things like that.
And it's also a lien against any property in the future, at least for several years. He goes to buy something or goes to inherit something, and it attaches to the property. So,
okay.
But that gets,
well,
that's
thank
a complicated.
You so much.
No, my pleasure.
I greatly appreciate your service to the community that you're offering through the air, and I thank you so much. This has been very useful for me. Thank you, and be well.
Thank you, and thank you for joining us in your legal rights. And let me pass on a related question to my guests. This question was written in, sent in by Harry, who asks, particularly for any attorney representing landlords, given the strong new state laws protecting tenants from evictions, how would any attorney still recommend becoming a landlord when you may be up against someone whose tenants' rights completely outweigh your landlord property recovery rights, plus the insanity of allowing squatters to take over properties as strictly civil issues rather than the criminal issues of prison time. And finally, he asks how you would recommend renting out a single-family home.
Well, there's a lot in that. Single-family homes have the least restrictions if they're owned by individuals. So how to do it, I mean, that's too broad of a question, but it is the least restrictive rental for a landlord to rent out. I'm assuming it's because it's sort of a luxury. So the person renting it isn't as, needing of assistance perhaps, or, inexpensive housing as somebody living in a multiple unit building, maybe. I don't know what the logic is for that right now.
Basically, as we described earlier in an earlier broadcast, somebody renting a single family home or maybe one side of a duplex doesn't receive the same level of protections. The scale doesn't tip as far on the tenant side as it would with somebody who owns 8, 10, 12 units.
Yeah, that's right. That's correct. And I would still recommend being a landlord to someone who had a single family house that they were thinking about renting. I wouldn't have any problem with recommending that. Geographically, maybe I would tell my clients that don't recommend them being a landlord in San Francisco or maybe in Oakland as being the two, I think, worst cities for landlords. But elsewhere, it's really not that bad, especially San Mateo County. We really, it's very rare for a landlord to lose a case, especially in non-payment of rent cases in San Mateo County. I think out of thousands of cases my firm has had, we could count the ones we lost maybe on fingers of one hand over the years. So that's a pretty good record. And I'm not just trying to brag for myself, but I'm saying generally for landlord attorneys, San Francisco is a little bit more difficult, but Sal and Jessica can speak more to that.
And sort of in line with what David just said, in San Francisco, if an investor, takes into account the the condition of the property and the, you know, the estoppel certificates. They know what it's bringing in. They're going to be willing to pay a price that takes into consideration the income of the property. So maybe it's going to bring the property value down on the sale, but they'll also be factored in that, hey, I'm going to need legal services here probably at some point. So that'll further bring down the price of the property. So there should always be room for investors to be willing to go in into a property, even in San Francisco. And maybe the property values are going to come down in San Francisco to reflect the difficulties, you know, in the future of getting up to speed and complying with these, with these more stringent laws.
You know, my landlord type clients tend to be small owners. You know, they own their own home and mom passed away and they inherited a house that they want to rent out or something like that. And, it's tough. If you want to go into the landlording business, you should think of it as a business and how much time that's going to take. You know, if you've also got, you know, three or four small children, and you've got to work two jobs or something, then it may not be the best choice because you don't have the time to do it properly. You know, think of it as a business. You're going to have to think about how much time you have to invest into being a landlord.
Well, we're pretty much out of time, but I wanted to give each of you about 2 minutes for any final thoughts. Who would like to go first? Up to 2 minutes.
Well, I'll go start. This is Salvatore.
I think landlord-tenant law is like a pendulum, and it sort of swung all the way during the pandemic to the tenant side, and now it's coming back. I would say it's sort of in the middle of the spectrum right now. So it's not as bad as that caller thought it was. And I certainly wouldn't agree with Sal. I wouldn't tell any investor don't invest anywhere, except maybe I'd be more cautious in San Francisco and Oakland than elsewhere.
And who would like to go next? Jessica?
I just wanted to, mention a couple of things that there were AB 2559 passed this year, and that permits tenants to reuse third-party tenant screening reports for multiple applications within 30 days of the date of that report. So it used to be a lot of landlords would require tenants to get a new report. You know, if you apply to landlord A, B, and C, and each of them required their own reports, and that was expensive. So this has now gone through. Tenants can reuse third-party tenant screening reports for multiple applications within 30 days of the date of the report.
And Sal Timpano, any last thoughts?
Yes, thanks, Jeff. So, on this program, we discuss landlord-tenant issues. Most of the issues are problematic. I would like the listeners to take into consideration that most landlord-tenant relationships in California are very good. And if they weren't, we'd need triple the court system. And so we're hearing, on the program, some of the problems with landlord-tenant law and how to address them. And I think it's important for landlords to do their background checks, and it's important for tenants to know their obligations and keep up those, like most landlord tenants are doing those relationships. That's all.
Sure. It's a lot like, lotto winnings. You know, you only hear the ones who win really big, there's no report about who didn't win on their scratchers, for the last 6 months. Right.
Yeah.
We have about a minute and a half left. We do have one last minute call from Regina. Let's see if we can help out. Regina, you're on the air. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi. I have a tenant in Fremont, and everything was fine until they moved out. And a couple of days later, we found out that there was a horrible infestation of cockroaches, and we had to, get rid of all of the appliances that was recommended. And I charged my tenants for half of the appliances, like half of all the money I spent. now he's suing me for the, you know, the deposit back. I was wondering if that was okay to do, and what can I do to win this case?
Well, you need
This is Salvatore. Oh, go ahead, Jessica.
Oh, I was just going to say you need to work with your pest control people to show that that was the best and only way to deal with the cockroach incident. And also, you need to be able to prove that the cockroaches were the tenant's fault. Because I think if you can't show that it was the tenant's fault, you might have a problem.
Well, I mean, I can't really show that, but they didn't inform us. You know, it was a long-term problem as per my pest control person, and they didn't let us know. They were like, you know, it was a horrible infestation.
When you came into the property after they had left, what was the condition of the property like?
Yes.
It was very dirty. It was not well maintained in any way, but they probably sprayed something so we couldn't see the cockroaches when we came in for the first inspection. And just a few days later, when I came back on my own, it was just, you know, the place was overrun with cockroaches.
My understanding is roaches follow food. Where there's food, there's going to be roaches. No matter how much you spray. So I would say if you could show that there was trash, debris around in the appliances, on the floor, whatever, that should be.
You know, or if when you say the place was filthy, if some of those are food spots, like if they spilled spaghetti sauce and they didn't clean it up, or, you know, somebody dropped candy and didn't clean it up, those sorts of things, you've got photos of that, then that shows that, you know, it's related to the food and the tenants.
Okay, but there's nothing to prevent me from actually charging him, right? It's not illegal. I'm sorry.
Well, you know, landlords are allowed to deduct from the security for, you know, any damages that go beyond normal wear and tear, and having to get rid of appliances due to a cockroach infestation is well beyond normal wear and tear. However, the issue is going to be whether you can charge the tenants for up to half for all of that, you know, and that's where we say we need really good information from your pest control people, and you need that was the only way that was going to work, you know, that even if you had just cleaned the appliances, there was just no way it was going to work. You know, and if you've got you or the pest control people have photos of the cleaning process and the interim and like where the cockroaches were, you know, between floors and I don't know where all, but, you know, in infesting the appliances, that's going to be important. If you've got something from before the people moved in that showed that it was clean and sanitary, you know, that will also help to put the blame on the tenant.
I'm afraid we're out of time. If you want to stay on the line with me, I can finish up with you as soon as we're off the air.
Okay. Thank you very much. I will stay.
You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area, where we've been tonight focusing on landlord-tenant law. Several of you have called about our Call a Lawyer program. That is not yet operational. We are hoping to bring it back later this year. As of now, no date is set. Our guests tonight have been landlord-tenant attorneys extraordinaire Jessica Chalik and Salvatore Timpano of San Francisco and David Finkelstein of San Mateo. Our final guest tonight has been all of you. Our show tonight has been produced by yours truly. Please join us again for Your Legal Rights next week when we speak to deputy district attorneys engaged in consumer fraud law and environmental protections. Best of all, we'll take your calls and answer your questions. That's Your Legal Right. A big thanks to tonight's guests, Jessica Chalik, David Finkelstein, and Sal Timpano, and to all of you for listening. At the controls, Damian D. Minor. I'm Jeff Hayden. Have a good night and zealously guard your legal rights.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. And if you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. You can call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information. This is KALW San Francisco.